Welcome to In Gad We Trust, a podcast based in and around classic era, golden age detective fiction of the 1920s to the 1940s. My name is Jim, I blog at The Invisible Event, and the plan for this podcast is that each episode features me in conversation with fellow bloggers, with authors, with enthusiasts in the genre, to talk about a topic of their choosing. Joining me for this episode is comedian Alistair Beckett King. Alistair, welcome to In Gad We Trust.
Thank you for having me on the podcast.
This is going to be the first time that the podcast has reached outside of the mystery community, and I think I should probably explain a little bit for some people who are wondering quite what's going on or are confused and scared by this new face.
Why has a comedian come in? I'm honoured to have been brought into your parlour or drawing room.
I am delighted that you've come to join us, because Alistair came to my attention a few weeks ago when he did an interactive murder mystery through his Twitter account called Alistair Beckett King's Who Did It. It was brought to my attention by Carol. Thank you, Carol. I greatly appreciate that. It's tremendously good fun. And on the back of that, we ended up talking about detective fiction. We'll get into that in due course. But I didn't know, Alistair, if you wanted to start off by just sort of explaining the principles behind Who Did It to people.
The Who Did It is an interactive game that you can play, or you could play a couple of weeks ago, but you can still watch and still solve, where I posted a series of videos outlining a crime scene and a series of suspects who I play with a series of increasingly implausible wigs and costumes. Because all of this was produced under lockdown conditions, so it's just me in some very poor quality wigs. And I have to say, the intense shame of the first thing you buy in lockdown being a novelty wig is to know that a key worker had to bring me those wigs. That could have been insulin, that could have been anything essential, but it was like Smithy's wigs.
I assume they were like proper hairdos, because you have the hair to be put into the hairdos, right?
Yes, most of them are. I have, if you could just visualise sort of luxuriant chestnut cascading locks, like a Pre-Raphaelite painting, that's what I have. And yes, my girlfriend did an amazing job of coiffuring that for the female characters, but for a couple of the male characters, I needed to put on a short hair wig to cover up the fact that I have very long hair. If you have a look in the show notes and follow the link, you can watch all the videos, listen to interviews with the suspects, look at clues from the crime scene, and then you could, 2 weeks ago, vote about who you thought did it, but you can still, in your heads, work out who you think did it, and then watch the three-part denouement, because did you know that Twitter has a limit to how long videos can be? Because I didn't.
I discovered it by you discovering it, actually. So the thing I really appreciate about it is there are actually some very classic golden age detective fiction style, well hidden clues or well declared clues inside of.
I wanted to make it work like a mystery. My aim was for the person who did it. Oh no, I'm gonna give it away. If you look at the number of people who suspected the person who did it was what I wanted. But if I say who that was, then you'll see the graph and it will be obvious. And I'll give away the ending. But I wanted some people to get it, but I didn't want everyone to get it, because I think that's how it should be if it's fair. And I think it landed about the way I wanted it, which is good. And it is comedy. It is full of ridiculous characters and jokes. And it's very flippant and offhand. And, the videos are only sort of a minute, 2 minutes long. But I did want to make the clues work like a proper mystery would work, as well as I could. But it's very difficult doing it like this, because there's no proofreading for a video that goes on Twitter. There's nobody who I can check with. And I was doing it day by day. So I was writing the next monologue each morning and then recording it in the afternoon and then editing it and uploading it the next day. So there's a few things where if I went back, I would change that phrase, because actually that's an unintentional red herring, or I've hidden this a little bit too well. I haven't set that up. Nobody's noticed that. But for most of the buried clues, the tiny little gestures in the videos that give something away, pretty much everything got spotted by someone, although most people didn't spot all of them, which I think is ideal.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what you want. For my part, I managed to really fixate on the one detail that was not important in the least, thinking I'd been incredibly clever.
Well, that's probably an unintentional red herring that if I had had a chance to run it past someone, I would have taken out. I apologize.
Well, no, it's nice to be wrong. This is the lovely thing about murder mysteries. I think they are probably one of the few occasions when the human race quite enjoys missing the point and kind of being told, actually, no, you were stupid to think the thing that you thought. I don't think you can get away with that in very many other forums.
I think they have a lot in common with... I do a bit of writing for video games. I think they have a lot in common with video games in terms of the way we do engage with them as narratives or as drama. It's something perhaps that they also have in common with comedy. We're part of it too. Like in comedy, the audience needs to laugh. And if they don't, you've got a problem. Mm. And a murder mystery doesn't make sense if the audience, if the readership or the audience aren't trying to guess who it is, really. And if you've not set things up, if you've not given the information correctly, if you've not been fair, then readers know. They'll know that and will be cross with you, I think. I suspect, having never written a murder mystery apart from the Who Did It.
No, I think that's quite accurate. I wrote a little while ago on my blog something about how the writing of detective fiction is like the telling of a joke, and how you need the relevant information to be given in the correct order on the way to an ending that seems inevitable but is also surprising.
Yes.
And in exactly the same way that a joke is surprising if you get a laugh out of it, a murder mystery is surprising, or a piece of detective fiction is surprising if you get a facepalm and I really should have seen that out of it.
Yeah, and there's something, P.G. James, I think, talks about clues being presented fairly but deceptively.
Mm.
There's something about the way setups are written, and one-liner comics are brilliant at this, which is masking the important concept so that you have all the information you need, but you haven't made the connection until the punchline.
Mm.
There was an example when we spoke via email. You mentioned a joke from my stand-up show, the Alistair Beckett King Mysteries, which, in spite of its name, is not a murder mystery. I have a joke in that show which, if you don't mind, I will completely ruin by explaining in too much detail.
I'm happy for you to ruin it if you're happy to ruin it.
Also, it's a visual joke, so what better for a podcast medium than for me to explain a visual joke in detail? It's from a section of the show where I go through the pets of famous dictators, which I have invented. So Kim Jong-il's pet eel, Pol Pot's pet ocelot, and I show Joseph Stalin with his pet starling. And it's the famous photograph of Joseph Stalin on a bridge, famous for having had some of his former friends removed after they were removed. And I've photoshopped a little starling in next to Stalin. And then I say, of course, after that picture was taken, Stalin and the starling, they had a falling out, and he had him removed from the photograph. So you might recognise it like this. And then I click onto the next slide. And in the next slide, the starling is still there, but Joseph Stalin has been completely removed from the photograph, which I think is not funny on a podcast, but visually that is the funniest joke I've ever done. Because of the idea that the starling had the power to have Joseph Stalin removed and then airbrushed out of the shot. Really, the whole backstory you have to invent in your head in that split second for how that came to be. When really, it's just a rug pull. It's just not the thing you expected happening. But the wording of it has to be very careful. I have to scrupulously make sure that that sentence is ambiguous without you noticing it's ambiguous. Because the clue is there, but I have to present it fairly, but deceptively.
Part of the motivation behind this conversation is these parallels then between the surprise of classic-era detective fiction and the surprise of comedy, whether it's stand-up comedy, whether it's, you know, written comedy, whether it's comic strip comedy, whatever it is. This idea of trying to surprise people while also making them fully aware of what they are being told and what they're being shown. And the thing that I think particularly that comedy and detective fiction have in common is that they are almost very self-aware learning algorithms. Other comedians are aware of the work that's being done inside of comedy, in the same way that in classic era detective fiction authors were aware of what they were doing. I mean, fans of detective fiction will know that there was a social club set up in the 1930s called the Detection Club. Martin Edwards has written a book about that, The Golden Age of Murder, where we know that they would meet up and discuss plots and in some cases set up challenges to see who can come up with the best resolution to a particular solution. So there's an aspect of particular styles of joke potentially being overused and gradually falling by the wayside by dint of the fact that they become very predictable.
Yes. Yeah, there are stock formats which will have comedians rolling their eyes, but will have audiences probably chuckling or if not rolling in the aisles, that will mostly still work on audiences, but comedians will go, oh, come along. And we're probably all guilty of doing it sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. After the Alistair Becker King Mysteries show was streamed on YouTube, there was an interview with you afterwards in which you made the really interesting point there that there is a point in the show where you're talking about your veganism and you do the whole, are there any vegans present? And people put up their hands and there's a bit of follow-on from that. And then are there any vegetarians present? And people put up their hands and there's the follow-on from that. And I said to you off mic, like, I had subconsciously been expecting something along the lines of a, oh, well, they're all just too weak to put their hands up comment. And then you said in the interview afterwards how that is almost the expected kind of stock response. And so that's the kind of thing.
Yes, that is
hopefully.
That is a hoary old chestnut. The vegetarians in, oh, yeah, there's loads of them. They're just too weak to put their hands up. Ha, 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 ha. It's so funny. That is a very tiresome joke. But yeah, so there are specific jokes which you know, belong to the old club circuit, which were literally just stock jokes. You'll still see in after-dinner speaking circles and things like that.
Well, this is it. So I thought on the back of that, I thought what I would do in attempt to prove that I'm not just making this up, I thought I would give an example of this kind of hoary equivalent in detective fiction.
Oh, I'd love that.
Okay, so I'm going to have to spoil, I'm afraid, one of the Sherlock Holmes stories, The Valley of Fear. So please forgive me, anybody listening, if you haven't yet read The Valley of Fear. Alistair, have you read it?
Read Sign of Four and A Study in Scarlet.
Would you prefer if I didn't?
Nah, go on. Go for it. Okay, cool. I probably would have worked it out anyway.
Yeah, of course. Of course. I mean, you've written a murder mystery.
Yeah,
now,
yeah. So, I think I know a thing or two about mysteries. No worries.
So, in short, Holmes and Watson get invited down to a country estate where the squire is found having been shot in the face, point blank range, by a shotgun. And long story short, this is where the spoilers come in. It is discovered that, in fact, the body that's had its face obliterated by the shotgun is not that of the squire, and was, in fact, the man who attacked him. The shotgun went off by accident, and the squire simply swapped his clothes over with the corpse so as to appear that he was dead, because there was someone out for his blood, and he wished to give the impression of being dead. Was that what you were expecting?
Yes.
Good.
In fact, one of my proudest moments in life, and this is to my great shame, was coming back in from a gig where my girlfriend was watching, I think, Endeavour, the Morse spin-off.
Yep.
And she summarised the plot for me. And I said, it was the Doctor. And she said, no, it wasn't the Doctor, he's dead. And I said, nope, he wasn't dead because he was hit in the face with acid, and nobody whose face has been obliterated in a murder mystery is ever the person who they are. It's almost certainly the person who you thought was dead who did it.
This is it. So this became known as the Birlstone Gambit.
Ooh, that's a great name.
It is a great name. I believe, if I remember correctly, it's because the country estate is called Birlstone, or it's Birlstone House or something like that. So, as you quite rightly say, pretty much every single time you get a faceless corpse, or a faceless and fingerprintless corpse, I suppose, as our understanding of forensic medicine improved, it's the Birlstone Gambit, which means the corpse you have is not actually the corpse of the person you think it is. Now, Conan Doyle was not the first person to use the Birlstone Gambit, but I just think by the sheer popularity of Holmes by this point, it's about 1914, I think, The Valley of Fear is from. So this particular trick became synonymous with this story. And detective fiction being this sort of this large, self-aware sort of organism quickly adopted and adapted this idea then of, if I have a faceless corpse, potentially it's not going to be the person I think it is. You couldn't then have 40 or 50 years of murder mysteries where a faceless corpse turns up and, oh my God, suddenly 300 pages later it turns out that the corpse without the face is not the person who you think it is.
Mm.
which is not to say people still don't use it. There is an author who I will call a best-selling crime writer, I suppose, a contemporary.
Oh, how dare you! How catty of you!
I'm afraid I'm not.
You don't
up
mince
enough.
Words. A best-selling crime writer. I can tell what you think.
There is a best-selling crime writer who is publishing today, who wrote a novel late 90s, I think it was. I want to say about 96 or 97. And the entire book revolves around the Burlstone Gambit. Page 4, we have a facelift corpse. Page 382, it turns out the corpse is actually not of the person we thought it was of. So there is still a strata of mystery writing where these tropes exist and are used, almost as if they are sort of fresh bait. But inside of... I don't want to get pompous and say the proper mystery community, but inside of certainly what we're talking about in terms of your very classic fair play detective fiction, the Burlstone Gambit is very well known and is sort of slightly eye-rolly if somebody tries to get away with it with a straight face.
I should imagine there are novels and short stories that rely on your expectation that they're going to do that and that trick you by it turning out to actually be the person you thought it was in the first place, using it as a red herring to mislead you. So
precisely.
You will be convinced it's not that person when in fact it is.
So then, yeah, what started to happen was they started to complicate this by mixing in stories of, well, I think he had a brother who no one's seen for 20 years or equivalent things like this. And so obviously you get the, well, maybe the brother did exist and this could be the brother. But this is exactly it. Detective fiction learned that there was this particular trope and then found a way to continue to use it. But also, yeah, like you say, to make it part of the game. And then is it a red herring? Is it not a red herring? Do you trust someone well enough to know that they're not using this? Are they relying on the fact that they've already written 20 novels and are some internationally best-selling author to get away with kind of sneaking a Burlstone Gambit under the fence? It all kind of plays into part of the game, part of the expectation and part of the outcome, I suppose, and part of the surprise that you're looking for in the writing of a detection plot.
I think comedy has probably the similar conversations. I probably any medium does once you get to the sort of the insiders or the people who consider ourselves connoisseurs or super fans. Mm. Like I suppose with comedy, the obvious reference in the UK would be Stuart Lee or Daniel Kitson, whose stand-up involves some element of deconstruction. And you have to have an awareness of the tropes of stand-up to be able to see what the point of it is, which is not to be sneering towards stand-up, which is about jokes being funny, which I think is fine. But if you go into it with a sort of a naive outlook, then there might be less in there for you.
Yeah.
Just like if you go naively into a Burlstone Gambit, expecting it to be that corpse, and it turns out to be that corpse, then there's no twist. If you That's weren't fair. Already aware that was a trope. I used to open sets by saying, it's become very popular for comedians to open their sets in a slightly American way by saying to the audience, "Are we good?" And then the audience goes, "Way!" And that has always annoyed me because I am English and I think that good is a value judgment. And so I would open by saying, "Are we good?" And they'd go, "Way!" And I said, "No, I mean morally." And... That would get a laugh, but it wouldn't always get a laugh, because you have to be aware that comedians open their sets by saying, "Are we good?"
Yeah,
to realise that it was a joke. So it wasn't enough of a Burlstone Gambit. It's not a sufficiently established thing, and I'm not Stuart Lee, and I don't have a loyal fan base that will come along expecting that sort of thing, wanting to see how you're going to play with the form. To mainstream audiences in that context, that doesn't work because the expectation I was trying to play off haven't been there.
Yeah, that's fair.
I tried to write another one for the show that I'm working on now, and this didn't work at all, which was asking the audience, "Are we drinking tonight?" And they went, "Way!" And then just making a little note of that and telling them that I plot it on a graph, which I found very funny because I hear comedians say, "Are we drinking tonight?" many, many, many times a week. Yeah. And I find it exhausting because they're always drinking and you don't need to ask them. It should just take it as a given that they're drinking. Why ask them? It really annoys me. But I actually do know the reason that the comedians ask it, which is to get the audience to say, "Way!" But yeah, the audiences are not aware that is something that only I've observed. It's an observation that the audience can't share in, and so it just doesn't work as a joke.
Is there not an element, though, you can rely on a certain amount of the audience, and so it's almost like you're making a joke to, say, 15% of the audience?
Yes, but those percentages are too low. you can't really build a set on jokes that only land for 50, unless you're Stuart Lee and you just get an entire audience of 15%ers.
Yeah, that is true.
It's a risky gambit.
Yeah, that's fair. I say this as a teacher, very aware of the fact that sometimes I make a joke that only two students in 30 are supposed to find funny. You know, but I forget people aren't paying to see me teach. So.
Yes, that's fine as long as they're legally obliged to be in the room with you.
I just think because, again, there's this idea that you're going to get, every time somebody picks up a murder mystery, you're going to get people who have read, you know, hundreds and hundreds of books in the genre, and potentially that same book is going to be picked up by someone, you know, and it will be their first mystery. In the same way that you, as a comedian at a show, you're going to get people who have been to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of gigs, and potentially you're going to get people for whom, again, this is their first gig or one of their very first live gigs. And I think it must be, again, very difficult in both mediums trying to plan for that broad a... I almost want to say ability, but that's quite Stuart Lee, isn't it?
yes. I don't think there's any reason to patronise people who like comedy which is straightforward. Like comedy which is straightforward. I have a very, very sort of Catholic taste in comedy, which doesn't mean that I feel guilty about what I like. I mean, won't do that joke again. That was the first... That was a new, fresh joke there that I thought of. Forget that.
Yeah, but I'm part of the Stuart Lee 15% audience, so it's fine. Stuart Lee's my favourite living stand-up, so you know, so I'm not your target audience.
Oh, good. At least it means you understand what I'm getting at there. Hmm. I went to film school before doing stand-up, and a lot of the talk in drama is about the sort of the low value of surprise, because one of the first script that film students write, and this is certainly true of me, is often about withholding some piece of information from the audience, like so that there's a twist. And then at the end, it turns out that protagonist you liked was a murderer, which in drama is fair enough, is quite low value. There's not much suspense about somebody not telling you something that you should know.
Yep.
Whereas, you know, suspense is more about giving people the information. There's a bomb on the bus. When's it going to go off? Mm. Finding out at the end that the bomb goes off is not very exciting, as Hitchcock and many others pointed out. Mm. But the weird thing about comedy and mysteries, and also tales with a twist, which I also really like as a sort of subgenre of mystery writing, is we need surprise. It doesn't work without surprise. And maybe that's one of the things that makes it a cheaper, degenerate and unrespected art form, that you really do have to surprise people with the punchline. You do have to try and surprise people with who did it in a whodunit in order to make it work. And perhaps the other thing it has in common, as I mentioned to you off camera, off mic rather, is that you've got often very clever, excessively educated people doing it as a little bit of a potboiler thing, or rather people putting vast intellect that ought to be trying to ought to be somewhere in academia towards something that's fun, squandering their intellects and talent, which is quite an interesting thing to think about. I'm thinking about Dorothy L. Sayers, who was a serious academic, and
Cecil Day Lewis.
I don't know Lewis.
Poet laureate, and he wrote a bunch of novels as Nicholas Blake, but a bunch of detective novels.
I recognise the name Nicholas Blake. But I meet a lot of comedians, and you very rarely meet a thick comedian. There are very few. And there are comedians who play, who seem stupid, and there are working class comedians who people will say, oh, this is stupid, easy comedy. And I get very annoyed about that, because I don't think that is true. I think it's very hard to do funny stuff if you're not clever. Although not all comedians are ostentatiously, academically, not everybody is out there to beat you over the head with their vocabulary.
Yeah.
But you'll go a long way before you meet a thick stand-up comedian who's good at it.
It's interesting you should say that, because one of the things that really struck me as a similarity, again, with mysteries and with stand-up, is that to go into them, the audience in the gig or the reader in the book, you're often aware of the fact that what you're entering into is a very deliberately falsely constructed milieu, I suppose. Mm. I mean, again, at the start of the ABK mysteries, you come out and you have this thing of, oh, you know, you're this side, here am I... family the Becketts, and here's my family the Kings.
Yes, that's a very obviously constructed conceit where I pretend that audience members are people I know already.
Absolutely. Or something like, I think of someone like Al Murray when he comes out and does The Pub Landlord.
Yes.
Who has that very deliberate, oi, hoo, yeah, you know, that very, very forceful personality, which is so obviously pastiche, and which then pulls you into the kinds of things which, if he were to say them in his normal voice with a straight face, simply would not be funny. But because you are so very quickly sort of embraced in the fiction, I suppose, in which you're trying to envelop your audience, that very much helps get into the spirit of the show much more quickly, in exactly the same way that most people, if there is a murder in the house, are not just going to hang around in the house because they were told to by the amateur detective who is actually a, you know, he professionally collects butterflies in his spare time and just wanders along to help solve murder mysteries when the spirit takes him, right? Or most of us, if we ended up on an island being killed one by one, we would find a way off the island. I it strikes me that a lot of the time, to be as successful as possible in terms of selling that milieu, you almost have to get people on board with it incredibly quickly with both cases and get them looking at what you're saying and what you're telling them in a particular way so that they then overlook the things you don't want them to see on the way to a surprising conclusion. Again, be that either a joke or be that, oh my God, he was the killer all along.
I guess there is a contract, I suppose, an unspoken contract that has to be established. And it can work and it cannot work. In stand-up, that's very obvious, especially when it comes to things like, you know, hecklers. The general and broadly understood rule about heckling is that it's hilarious and comedians love it because it gives them an opportunity to ad lib. And, of course, the reality is that almost everybody can't stand it. Because we've written really good jokes that are way better than asking the person sitting next to you if they're your carer, which gets a huge laugh every time someone does it, but is a stock joke that belongs to no one and is done by almost every comedian on the circuit. Although I always worry that it's a little bit ableist, so I never do it. But people, you know, something funny that happens in the room spontaneously is always funnier than something that's been prepared. And so, a back and forth with a troublesome audience member can be hilarious. And with a select few comedians or on a select few nights, it is hilarious. When something genuinely, completely original happens, that's delightful. But it's very, very rare. If you go to enough comedy gigs, you'll see hecklers be put down in the same way over and over and over again. Mm. And to a great extent, those are people who didn't understand the contract. I think heckling is fine as long as the heckler is original and funny, which it rarely is.
Yes.
If you can actually shout something out that's genuinely funny and get a laugh, then well done. But you are in a minority. But that can break things down. If a comedian loses control, if people lose faith in a comedian, if the contract and the one-sided conversation of stand-up can become a genuine conversation, and it stops being entertainment. And I think mystery writers can probably break that contract as well, because, as you said, there's an implicit understanding, which is, okay, we'll suspend our disbelief about how realistic this behaviour is and about whether this butterfly collector or this out-of-work actor would actually be allowed to go to a morgue to investigate corpses on behalf of the police force. We'll not ask any of those questions, but you've got to play fair with us and present the clues, because if you produce a long-lost cousin in the last chapter, we are going to be pretty annoyed with you.
I think there's a reason that mystery novels are not generally written on that choose your own adventure basis, isn't it? They're not trading in that kind of interaction. You know, you don't go into a comedy gig, or I don't imagine you go in as a stand-up and go, if you would like the punchline to the joke to be this, please raise your hand. Okay, that's a majority. That's fine. In that case, that's the punchline, and now we'll go down this route. I don't know. Maybe that's a comedic model that's going to work at some point.
I've tried it. I've done a live choose your own adventure show.
Yeah,
and I've written for a number of indie games that involve letting the player choose things. And of course, my Twitter murder mystery was interactive, but I had to limit the ways in which the players were allowed to influence the story, and they're mostly superficial throughout.
I would be terribly surprised if you were at all surprised by the outcomes of most of those options.
I genuinely wasn't trying to direct people towards one outcome, especially since I had to film the alternatives, knowing that the people were only going to choose one of them. People often didn't go for the one that I wanted, but a general rule is if you give people a list and one of them is funniest, people will go for that one.
This is
even if it isn't the most interesting for the story, which is why you should be very careful about when you offer people a choice.
Yeah, that's fair.
There's a very interesting YouTube channel called Game Maker's Toolkit by a guy called Mark Brown, former games journalist who writes about how video games work, and he has a very interesting one about murder mysteries. Because the big problem with games is asking you, how do you, the player, tell the game that you have worked it out?
Yes.
Because it works okay if it's a list of suspects. Who did it? Click on the face.
Yep.
But for anything more subtle than that, and mysteries involve making all sorts of subtle detections. There's a very good game in the video, a good puzzle in Discworld Noir, where you have a corpse hung up by his feet, who's written what appears to be Azile, A-Z-I-L-E, on the wall. Mm-hmm. And the game has to come up with a way for the player to realise that they must actually have written a series of numbers beginning with 3. The E is actually a 3 upside down. They've written it upside down because they were hung upside down.
Yes.
But how does the game ask you to work that out? How can you tell the game you've worked that out without the game giving you the option? He was hung upside down, and so the numbers were upside down. At which point, if you hadn't worked it out, you've read it.
Yes.
The problem video games have is they have to present you with the option to work it out. The solution in that case is you combine two clues together. You combine Azile with hung upside down, and the player character will go, oh, so if he was hung upside down, then this must be upside down. But it's still quite possible for a player to simply randomly combine those and have the protagonist do the working out for them.
Absolutely.
It's a real challenge, and he goes through a number of interesting examples of how games have succeeded and mostly failed in doing that.
That sounds fascinating. What was it called again? What was the channel called?
Game Maker's Toolkit, GMTK, is the channel. And there's only one of them about mysteries, but it's very interesting because it is a huge, huge problem, because most mystery video games are actually mystery-flavoured video games in which you pilot a character who solves a mystery, which is not the same thing as you solving a mystery. And the big problem of them is they often, because the properties are either licensable or in public domain, you often play as Poirot or Sherlock Holmes, which doesn't work because you don't have the little grey cells
exactly,
or the observational skills of Sherlock Holmes. And you can simulate the observational skills by giving him special powers, but you can't simulate the inductive reasoning for which these characters are famed if the player can't do it.
There was a game created around a couple of Agatha Christie novels. There was one based on Murder on the Orient Express, which I have not played, but which I understand is very highly regarded in terms of that intuitive combination or deductive combination of different information that you have collected, and the way in which you choose to interpret it and the way in which information is given is supposedly quite good. There is one based on the ABC murders, which is awful.
I'm aware of that, and it's quite popular among nerdy game fans, and I have steered clear of it because it had the look of the type I'm seeing you rolling your eyes on my little camera screen.
The start of the book begins with a murder of, I can't remember, but it's someone whose initials are AA, and they're murdered in Andover, and so they're in a chemist's or something like this, some sort of shop. And you walk in as Poirot, and you're supposed to notice particular things. And so, like, you move the mouse around the screen, and when you light on something that's relevant, it lights up with this kind of red glow or something, if I remember correctly. And so you pick it up, and you look at it, and it tells you what it is. And then you go, okay, I want to leave. And it goes, well no, but you haven't found everything.
Yes.
You go, I can't find anything. Well, I don't care. You haven't found anything. There's still 3 things you haven't found. And you're like, oh.
This is true. God. We're happy to credit the detectives with preternatural deductive abilities, but their psychic ability to know when they've found all the clues in a room is something that has not been established in the source material.
It's weird, isn't it? It's really
And
odd.
The other thing is, because you're the player, you can make errors.
Yes.
And mystery novels are inviting you to make errors throughout the process of watching or reading a mystery. Mm. But the problem is, if you're the player character, if you're Holmes, then you have to make that error. Mm. For instance, I'm playing, there's a very bad series of Sherlock Holmes games by Frogwares, and the latter ones are supposedly much better. So I've picked up one of the later ones, which is Sherlock Holmes Crimes and Punishments, and I'm playing it now, and it has the same issues. It's got some improvements, but Holmes still has a magical ability to know whether he's found most of the clues, but it does allow you to get it wrong. So it's it's not quite as pedantic as that.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But at the very beginning, there's you've got a crime scene and an object dropped in the blood of the murder, a little notebook with somebody's initials on it. And you've got somebody who had tried to break into that crime scene while the police were guarding it. So after the crime had occurred, it had been locked, and overnight someone tried to break in. And early on, in sort of linking together your ideas, in very much the way I described in the video game Discworld Noir, Holmes deduces that whoever tried to break in to take the object which is in blood must be the killer. You think, well, no. No, of course that person, I mean, that's not how logic works. Yeah. That person might be the killer,
yeah,
but it doesn't follow that they necessarily are the killer.
Have to be, yeah.
Because an object can be dropped into blood after a murder has occurred.
Yeah.
An object can be on the floor and be bled upon if it was already there. And I know that as a mystery reader, and I don't mind being expected to think that at a certain point in a story. But the idea that Holmes thinks that is absurd, yeah, because of course it doesn't prove that that person did it, whoever they may be. There's an infinite variety of reasons they might have been trying to break into that room. We should definitely try and catch them and interview them. But the problem is it forces you to go through those steps. And so it turns Holmes into a sort of a witless puppet, and it undermines the character. And the character of Sherlock Holmes is one of the things people like about Sherlock Holmes.
And it's fascinating that the concept of the sidekick in detective fiction has become known as the Watson, based purely on,
yes,
Watson in Holmes, with what the idea is that Watson is obviously your sort of reader-level intelligence. Ronald Knox wrote a series of rules. He wrote 10 commandments for detective fiction. And one of them was the Watson character must only be, you know, slightly less intelligent than the average reader. It's amusing to reflect on the idea that part of the appeal of Holmes is that Watson is what makes him accessible. And so by making the reader play as Holmes, you effectively turn Holmes into Watson.
Mm. Yes, that's it. Yes, Holmes has been Watsoned. And
yeah.
And we all slightly despise Watson for his,
oh, my goodness, Holmes, you can't mean that.
For his constant surprise at Holmes' abilities to solve crimes, that, bearing in mind that he solves them every single time, apart from maybe one.
Yeah.
But you're right, I think in a way Watson is not one of the best Watsons, ironically, because he is a little bit too thick. And a lot of this is like the Universal movies adaptations of Watson, where he is, you sort of think, were you really in a war? Because you look like you'd be rubbish in a war.
you have a medical qualification.
They've got guns, they're shooting at us. And we have guns. Oh, my goodness. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
No wonder you got shot.
Yeah, poor old Nigel Bruce.
It's a very good comic performance there. I think probably the first mystery that really grabbed me was Jonathan Creek, which is not a proper written-in-a-book murder mystery. But I think Caroline Quentin's character, Maddie, in the verse series of that, is one of the best sidekicks available, because she's completely driving the story forwards all the time.
Yeah.
And the plots are so ludicrous, and the contrivances so Byzantine, that her explanations are reasonable. You know, her bafflement is how she is on the level of the viewer.
Yeah.
And it's quite unreasonable in everything apart from the episode where an alien appears to disappear, which is based on an old magic trick that I know, and so I solved it. How weird that there would be a crossover between video games, comedy, mysteries and magic. The four coolest mediums.
And Alfred Hitchcock keeps cropping up every single episode.
Even though
Hitchcock
is very, very much the anti murder mystery.
Detection. Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know pretty early on who did it, and you just have to watch other people find out who did it.
Yeah, which is the inverted mystery, which is what the very second episode of this podcast was on. I'm telling you, this is like my Slumdog Millionaire. This is crazy. David Renwick was himself a magician's assistant, wasn't he? He was actually involved in, I think, either the creation or the setting up of magic tricks.
Is that right?
Yes. The Jonathan Creek episodes are full of what I take to be very kind of Easter egg-y references to, you know, classic early magic, certainly, classic early mysteries. I mean, the easiest example to cite is that one of the Jonathan Creek specials takes place in Doomdorf Castle, which has to be named after the Doomdorf mystery, a very famous impossible crime story by the Melville Davidson Post. It's as much as Jonathan Creek may not be a in inverted commas, proper written murder mystery. I think it is very much written and was created in the wake of the written murder mystery and obviously the written Impossible Crime, because all but one of the episodes looked at Impossible Crime.
I think Impossible Crime is an interesting one. I have, during lockdown, got massively into watching Death in Paradise. And I say that with, initially, shame, and now nothing but pride, because it has brought joy to me day after day. My partner was watching it, and I was saying, oh, you can't be watching that. I like sophisticated mysteries. And I've come to appreciate it for its wonders. I also I re-edited The Wire to replace the theme tune from The Wire with the theme tune from Death in Paradise. And I put that on Twitter. And the creator of Death in Paradise commented and said, oh, this is good. And so David Simon from The Wire has not been in touch. So I have completely changed my opinion of those two shows. But if you haven't watched Death in Paradise and enjoyed the incredibly ironically inappropriate upbeat theme tune that comes right after Bloody Murder every time, it's a show that very much knows what it's doing. But I think one of the mistakes they make in the writing of that, in a few episodes, is that they create impossible murders that are created on purpose, where the murderer has decided to commit a murder that nobody could have done, which is, I think, breaks one of the rules of fairness, which is that people should behave moderately rationally. And if you're going to commit a murder and you want to get away with it, you should either make it look like a crime didn't occur or make it look like somebody else did it. But deliberately creating a crime nobody could have committed is a waste of time. And Jonathan Creek, most of the time when an impossible murder occurs or an impossible crime occurs in Jonathan Creek, it's because of something unexpected happening. It was rarely intended to be an impossible crime. It's an impossible crime because of some bit of happenstance or some unpredictable freak coincidence that meant that they didn't quite get away with it in the way they intended to get away with it. And that's what I like, because I think that's fair, I think. Even though it's still extraordinarily unlikely, but we live on a planet with billions and billions of people, so weird things happen every day.
Yeah, this is I am a massive proponent of the impossible crime. I adore the impossible crime in fiction, and I would say the unlikeliness is an inherent part of an impossible crime. You know, the notion that these things are going to come together in exactly the way they do to produce exactly the effect they do is incredibly unlikely, but it is also really
good
fun.
Which is why the connection with the magic is appropriate, because everything magicians do is completely within the bounds of physics.
Mm.
And the solution to any magic trick is spend your entire life doing something completely pointless in order to get very good at it and be able to do it without people seeing.
Yeah.
And or noticing, rather.
Yeah.
And then you will understand it. So there's nothing remotely impossible about any magic trick. None of us would believe that anybody would devote that amount of time to learning how to hold a card behind their fingers when they're held together, or holding a stack of coins in the middle of their palm when it's face down. Yeah. None of us would believe that anybody would do that, even though they would, and so they can baffle us. But I think what is troubling in the bad impossible crime is when the murderer has relied upon that coincidence occurring. So when a murderer relies upon, well, when they see the body, they will react in this certain way. Well, no, they won't, because human beings are too unpredictable. Mm. Far better for the impossible thing to have occurred because of somebody behaving in an unpredictable way than for a murder to have neatly occurred because some Machiavellian or Moriartian genius was able to exactly predict the way a human being would behave in a moment of shock.
I tell you what, you would hate the ones then that rely on the prediction of animals behaving in a particular way.
Oh, that is. Well, it depends. Is it running towards food? Because I think I could accept that.
There is one that relies on. I don't want to spoil anything. There's one that relies on animal running, certainly, in a particular situation.
Mm.
There's one that relies on an animal doing something that a lot of the same animal are present and also doing. And so sort of the Nuremberg defense, I think it's known as. and there are a couple where animals simply happen to intervene. I will tell you my favourite bad animal intervention. There's a.
Do you have a jingle for that in the podcast? It's the bad animal intervention.
I don't yet, but I probably should. It's where a man is found shot in the head at very close range. So there is a powder mark on his temple where the gun has been pressed against his head when it was fired. And he is in the middle of a mud flat where it's just his footprints have walked into the middle of the mud flat. He has been shot there and fallen where he is. Fine. But there's no gun. And so there would be no way, obviously, for anybody to have approached him without leaving footprints. If he, let's say, carried them on his shoulders, there would be no way for anybody to get away and take the gun without leaving some kind of footprints, right? So it's how on earth could he have been shot? How on earth could the gun possibly have vanished? The solution is that it was suicide. He actually walked into the mud and shot himself, and then a pigeon flew down and made off with the gun.
I think we're sort of in Python and the Holy Grail questions about, I mean, how much weight is that? Well, what's that going to do to the airspeed velocity?
I believe the point is made that it is an especially light revolver, but nevertheless, it's...
At least magpies are attracted to shiny objects. I could certainly believe a magpie taking away a piece of crucial evidence.
I mean, there
perhaps
is...
Perhaps returning it at a later date, conveniently.
There is a novel in which that happened. There is a novel in which a magpie does make off with a murder weapon because it's shiny.
Now that's believable. That's in character. It matters. It does matter to me.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. I want to circle back around, actually, to something that you were saying about hecklers. Sometimes in murder mysteries, we will have a character almost behave as if they are the reader heckling the author as they're writing. There's a very famous example. Anthony Barclay wrote a novel called The Poison Chocolates Case. Now, The Poison Chocolates Case is a fascinating novel for all manner of reasons. Firstly, because structurally, what it does is it sets up a situation where a woman has been poisoned by some poisoned chocolates, and the police are at their wit's end, and so they enable, and this is again what we're talking about, kind of buying into the false setup of a murder mystery, they enable this, I'm not sure what you call it, I mean, they'd be podcasters today, you know, with this sort of true crime podcast thing, but there's effectively a murder group who meet every week and discuss murder cases. And so the police turn over all of the information they have about this crime to this group of six people. Everybody reads it, and the challenge is for them to come up with a solution to the murder. The revolutionary thing about the book is that there are then six solutions to the crime presented. So each of the six members of this group say, this is the interpretation of the crime based on what I have seen. I think it's about usually two chapters of each character putting across their perspective. And at the end of that character's second chapter, the next person to go will go, actually, I think you'll find there's something that you haven't considered. And then they will spin their solution based out of that oversight. And so they go through five false, incorrect solutions to the crime with the sixth.
Of course, that's why it's a chocolate box, because you can pick the one you want.
Well,
at
no,
that point,
well, potentially, but that's an interesting parallel. I'd never really considered that. But the idea is that each time the information that is added by the next solution undoes the previous solution. So you've chosen to put this interpretation on it, but actually, you should have looked at it like this. And so you go through, and then the final solution is the correct solution in the world of that mystery. So it's fascinating from that perspective. It's a genius piece of writing. It really is. Barclay was an incredibly innovative writer. He had some phenomenal ideas about the tropes of detective fiction, really long before they were tropes. I mean, Poison Chocolates Case is 1929. Ronald Knox wrote his Ten Commandments for detective fiction, I think, the same year. And then the Detection Club was formed the following year in 1930. And so it was around about that point then that the authors of these novels started to mix and mingle and, you know, one imagines start to compare notes. Anyway, the idea of a heckler, I suppose, interrupting a comedy show and derailing it is something which I think there is this parallel with, and particularly in the Poison Chocolates case, because there is a point early on where a character who is not a mystery author complains to a character who is a mystery author, well, all you mystery authors do is you tell us what the interpretation is going to be. So you give us a piece of information and then you say to us, because this is the information, this is the way that that is interpreted, and this is what it means. And so a lot of the times you claim that you're being fair and you claim that you're providing the information with all sort of due declaration and all sort of blue open-eyed innocence, but in fact all you're doing is you are simply misleading us sort of down a path while claiming that what you're giving us is perfectly correct and I suppose we could say fair facts that are going to lead us towards a conclusion, but you're able to cheat us in that way. And I love this idea because...
That's a pretty legitimate heckle, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
As heckles go.
I think so. It's a good one because... Again, there is that self-awareness of, people will definitely have read books where that is the case. Whereas you say, because somebody tried to break in, the person who tried to break in is therefore definitely the murderer. And you go, well, no, that doesn't hold. But you need that to hold in order to get to the solution that you want to be the solution. Mm. And it amuses me to think of writers writing characters to cavil them. One hopes that is the writer assuring you, the reader, that they are going to be fair, that they're not going to try and sort of push any of these shenanigans upon you.
I suppose there's two interpretations of that, I guess. I get one of them is sort of lampshading, I think is the term for it. Yeah. Of, well, I've noticed that I've got a bit of a problem here, and so I'll draw attention to it. I have a character go, well, isn't that extraordinary? And someone... in order to allow me to explain it, or at least will acknowledge that this outlandish coincidence is an outlandish coincidence. And the other is the more Stuart Lee thing of, well, isn't it interesting the number of horror stories that involve a horror writer going to a house or a mystery writer experiencing a murder mystery, because we've accepted the tropes and so we're going to enjoy an inside conversation. Absolutely. About how these things work.
And I mean, the number of mystery novels where somebody goes, it's almost like we're in a detective novel, there's that tremendous sort of nudging, winking sort of self-awareness, the tropes do become quite good fun in that regard.
Netflix has a drama about the missing days of Agatha Christie's life, she vanished, which is surprisingly good, and I don't want to spoil it, but it addresses the problem that most of her solutions have, which is you're not getting a conviction on any of this evidence. If that person hadn't grabbed a gun and tried to shoot a flapper girl when you said that they did it, there's nowhere they're going down. Based on you noticing a feather in their hat or something. And it brilliantly addresses that in a funny, witty way,
okay,
while also satisfactorily doing a very good pastiche of Agatha Christie.
That's very interesting.
So it cleverly sends it up for the fans in a way that isn't going to offend or upset anyone, because it's clearly a quite loving tribute. I think I haven't spoiled anything too much. I haven't said exactly how it works.
No, that sounds great. That sounds great. I think one of the ways in which perhaps the tropes of murder mysteries lead to them to differ from comedy is that there is something about the observation of the tropes that actually, as fans of mysteries, we really quite enjoy. So we really quite enjoy when someone turns around and says, oh, but, it's almost like we're in some kind of murder mystery play. It's almost like we're in some kind of detective drama. And to a certain extent, they become almost quite reassuring when elements of them crop up in books, right, and in stories. There was a blogger, a guy called Noah Stewart, who had a blog called Noah's Archives. He's an incredibly well-read man, and he wrote some deeply fascinating things about murder mysteries. One of my favourite posts of his was called The Golden Age of Detection Drinking Game, where he effectively went through this list of tropes and determined you take a drink when something particular turns up.
So I'm going to look that up straight away.
I'll just read through the first few. So, take a drink when anyone says, but he was already dead when I got there. Or when anyone says, of course, I didn't actually see him or her, but I know they were there. when the narrator casually mentions a little-known shortcut between two far-apart locations, because you can guarantee that's going to be an impossible alibi solution. When someone casually mentions a relative who vanished more than 20 years ago, if it's a twin, take two drinks. When the narrator casually mentions how much two suspects resemble each other. Things like this. It's called the Golden Age of Detection drinking game. I've linked to it countless times on my blog. I will provide a link in the show notes below.
I think my favourite one is anyone being spotted from afar who has a beard. An unknown person from at a distance with a beard, wandering bearded hobos, yeah, which turn out not to have been mysterious hobos coincidentally walking across a field.
Yeah. And there's an aspect of it where I think we really enjoy when these tropes crop up, when these kind of recurrent features crop up, so long as, much like your Birlstone Gambit, there's nothing wrong with having a faceless corpse that turns out to not be the corpse we thought it was, so long as that's not given to you on page 2 and turns out to be the shocking solution on page 283. Do you know what I mean? If you can stir these elements in to give it that air of familiarity, it's almost the more of an air of familiarity that these things stir in, the more audacity we're prepared to accept in the eventual solutions. And I wonder if that holds to a certain extent in comedy, not so much that you necessarily enjoy seeing exactly the same things again and again. You don't, as we were discussing earlier, you don't want somebody making the same joke about how vegetarians have no energy the whole way through. But at the same time, this signing up to a slightly ridiculous setup where you're not necessarily going to take everything that is said as the gospel truth. You know, people hopefully don't take too much offense at the kind of thing a stand-up comedian says. One supposes, provided the stand-up comedian has sold the world in which they want to make that comment, or the world in which they want to kind of draw those points together. You know, your Starling in the Starling joke, no one's going to get up and go, "That's absolutely ridiculous. There's no way that the Starling could organise for Starling to be photoshopped." I mean, it's distinctly possible that somebody might choose.
Photoshop didn't even exist in those days. It's not realistic.
I've seen that picture. I've got a history degree, and I think you'll find there's no bird in it originally.
People do that, obviously, with jokes, especially on Twitter.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I think there are often formats of joke, like the pullback and reveal joke, or in stand-up comedy, there's I know what you're thinking, and then doing a joke about your appearance, and it's often someone has let themselves go, and if you're a Stuart Lee fan, you'll be familiar with his excessively long series of versions of that.
Yep.
But Zach Galifianakis does the same thing, where he says his barber asked him what look he wanted, and then he does a very, very long list of funny ways of describing his appearance.
Yep.
Pullback and reveals, early in his career, Stuart Lee did a series of bits about, "And then I got off the bus," as a punchline, which is, you set up an unlikely situation, and then you say, "And then I got off the bus." And I suppose that is a bit cheap. But there are other ones, like, there is a name for this that I can't remember, but there is the format of joke where it's something like, "Have I Got News For You" has a good line in these. You know, Prince Philip was at the British Museum today. One of them is an old relic with no relevance in the modern era, and the other one is Prince Philip. No, I did it the wrong way around. The other one is the British Museum. Yeah. I unintentionally Stuart Lee'd it. You know the format of joke I mean. One of them is this, and the other one is the one you weren't expecting it to be.
Yes.
Except, of course, everybody knows the joke in advance now. Nobody is ever taken aback by that joke.
Yeah.
And they still get a laugh. Not because we're surprised, but because it gets a sort of a "Hey!" laugh of, we saw it coming and we're still enjoying it. The thing that comedy and murder mysteries have in common is that you are constantly thinking about how you are manipulating the audience in a way, which I guess any creative medium is doing, but it's not the same as... when I perform this scene of great sorrow, the audience are going to experience sorrow. It's a little bit more, okay, I want them to think of this, and then later on I want them to think that. It's a little bit more mercantile, a little bit more grubby than that. You are actually tricking them at times. You're cheating them. It's a bit more like doing a magic trick. But I don't think that's the starting point. I think the starting point is, this is really funny. This is a really funny idea, and it makes me laugh. How do I make them laugh? And how do I make sure that they have the information they need to find this funny the way I find it funny? And that's what takes a little bit of working out. And you try it by saying it in front of people, and then you try rearranging it. And sometimes I have one of my vegan jokes is about the way advice is very difficult if you're a vegan, because most advice in the English language comes in the form of axioms that aren't appropriate for our diet. You know, if you're a vegan, you can't have a bird in the hand, you can't kill two birds with one stone, you can't skin a cat in any way at all, you can't swing a cat in a room of any size, you have to cry over spilt milk. I'll give you, and this is me doing the bit, I'll give you an example of a piece of vegan advice. You can't make an omelette. And then I pause, and then after a very horrible beat where they don't laugh, audiences usually laugh.
Yeah.
Now, that joke began as a list of sayings that don't work if you're a vegan, and that was just one of the sayings. And I was doing that joke in the form of, you can't make an omelette without, because, you know, I didn't get the pausing.
Yeah.
So originally it was just a list, and I would say that list to people, and they would go, oh yeah, those things don't work if you're a vegan. And there's no joke. But changing it so that the audience have to complete the thought themselves makes it into a joke. Weirdly, that bit can be ruined by a heckler, because if I say, you can't make an omelette, if somebody at that moment says, without breaking any eggs, as occasionally an idiot will, it destroys the rhythm of the joke, even though everybody still understands the joke that I've made. And sometimes, and in that situation, I have to say, no, you just can't make an omelette. And that will get a laugh, but not the laugh it would have got if the audience had been allowed to complete that little jump themselves.
Yeah, that's fair.
Scrutinising jokes is very embarrassing to do, especially when it's your own jokes instead of really good jokes made by genius comedians. But I hope that illustrates the point that I was trying to make without being too self-indulgent.
The scrutinising of something, knowing where it's leading, is very interesting, certainly for me, in this kind of duality that we keep coming back to with detective fiction. Because I know there are people who say, oh, I will not reread a detective novel because I know what's going to happen. And part of me thinks you probably get the most out of a detective novel when you reread it. I'm starting to come round to this idea that actually when you have an idea of how everything is going to turn out, you really appreciate the artistry with which it is put together. I reread a book I posted about on my site recently called The Invisible Circle by Paul Altair. And I said in that post how much more I really enjoyed the book first time around, but just how much more I really enjoyed it second time around, watching the games that he plays and watching the way in which he uses particular characters and particular ideas to shift suspicion. And I wonder sometimes if, as a mystery novelist, it's incredibly difficult, after you've picked something apart again and again and again, to believe that it's still going to confound people. In the same way that I imagine with jokes, if you pick them apart again and again and again, are they still going to be funny to people?
Yes, it is difficult to believe that something is still funny when there isn't an audience there laughing, which is one of the hard things about doing remote gigs, doing gigs online, even though these jokes are definitely funny. You become familiar enough with them that they've lost any element of surprise. And that, maybe that's the time to try and write some new jokes, I suppose. But in principle, the jokes should still keep working because the audiences haven't heard them yet. Yeah.
Okay. The final parallel, I suppose, that I would seek to pull out of this increasingly tortured metaphor of comedy as detective novels and detective novels as comedy, is the way in which, in order to get a laugh or in order to get a surprise, you can put something in very early on which you then reverse or refer back to much later on in an unexpected way to show that it had some overall relevance. So what I'm talking about with the ABK mysteries is when you say about the difficulty that you have expressing emotion is because you don't have eyebrows on your face.
Yes.
And then at the end, you're doing the reading, you're getting everybody to close their eyes while you read to them, they open their eyes and you've stuck.
It's an extremely sophisticated comedy. Yes, what I've done is while people were listening to me reading a serious William Blake poem, I stick fake eyebrows onto my eyebrowless face. So that when they open their eyes, I look very silly.
Yes.
Which is funny in itself, but it's not anything more sophisticated than a callback.
No.
But you're right that there is a satisfaction in the callback, which is very similar to the satisfaction of when you, the aha moment in a denouement, where you go, I remember that, but I didn't notice it at the time.
Yes.
But I remember it happening, and I remember thinking it was a bit odd, and then forgetting about it. Which is the most satisfying kind of clue. You remember going, oh, no, that doesn't make sense because they do speak French in Canada, and then you forget about it. Yeah. And then later on, it's more, and you go, oh, yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah.
And that's how callbacks work. You essentially get a reward for remembering something. You're right now that you say it. There's something similar about that. Mm. There's something similar about not realizing that a clue was being planted.
What's so good about that eyebrow thing is that when you say it first time round, it is in itself a joke.
If I'm putting in this piece of information here, which isn't funny, the only reason to do that, it's like the magician's wand. Mm-hmm. It doesn't do anything. Mm-hmm. So the only reason to hold it is because you want me to look at it.
Yeah.
Because you're doing something else.
Yeah.
And I've seen this occasionally in other comedian sets. You'll give me a piece of information that I don't need, and I know to remember that because I'm a bad person, and I want to work out which callback that is going to lead to. And so I had to get that to the point, and I think I did, where that bit was funny in itself and would work as a standalone bit.
And I think this is exactly the same way that so many people will solve murder mysteries, because they will see something, a piece of information is dropped in. And there's no need for that piece of information to be dropped in. It has no particular bearing. There's a mystery author called Christiana Brand, and her novel Tour de Force is a superb murder mystery. But I solved it because really early on, she just mentioned something for no reason. And you go, well, this serves no narrative purpose. And that's weird, that sticks out suddenly. And then when the crime happens, however many pages later, I've just got this flashing light on the side of my head going, oh, so that's why, oh, okay, fair enough. Yeah. And you know, and then from that point on, it becomes, you know, to me, quite transparent. Well, on that note, I probably should let you go. Thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and talk about mysteries and comedy with me today.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me and for accepting all of my rambles with good grace.
No, this has been a lot of fun. As I say, it's really nice to be able to bring in something from outside of the typical community. And this particular duality is something that I do have a curiosity to be able to explore and to be able to talk about with someone who at least has... A far advanced understanding of it than my own.
Brilliant. Well, I was so happy to be involved. It's been really fun.
Thank you. And yeah, maybe we can get together and talk about Jonathan Creek at some point in the future.
Yeah, I'd love that.
Okay, cool. Thanks, Alistair. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.